Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhouseonline.com.au.
Well, in the history of humankind, a number of great revolutions have forever changed the way we communicate. First, there was the invention of writing. Next came the printing press, then broadcast media. And now, according to Professor Jim McNamara, we are in the middle of another great revolution, the social media revolution. Jim's a professor of public communication at the University of Technology, Sydney, and in his new book, The 21st Century Media Revolution, he says social media is changing society and culture as we know it. Jim is on the line. Jim, welcome to Open House.
Yes, thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Before we get into the whole social media thing, just let's paint the context and explain the traditional model of communication that was brought in by the printing and broadcast revolutions, because really we see social media against the backdrop of that. So just briefly touch on that.
I think that's an important way to look at it, because most of us have grown up in an era of what we call mass media. And really, for the last 100 years, media has increasingly fell into the hands, if you like, of a relatively small number of networks and broadcasters and media barons. And that's been because of the high cost, the high technology of mass media. And the average citizen has had less and less ways to communicate if they wanted to have mediated communication. And, of course, we still value face-to-face, but in many instances, to communicate across distance, we need some form of mediation. And against that background of increasing concentration of media, that's what makes social media so significant, is that suddenly there is ways of communicating that the ordinary citizen can access. So young people can do it for networking, we can use it for study, we can use it for research, we can use it to keep in touch with people, form new kinds of networks, or write and publish.
And all we have to do is go and get ourselves a free blog. So compared to the expense that was all a part of broadcast, you know, you can just sign yourself up to a free blog or Twitter or Facebook account, and before you know it, you're communicating to the world.
Well, yes, and it is very easy. Although, like all of the revolutions, one of the things I'm saying in the book is I think it's good to see the potential, but we also have to see that as in all changes, there are problems as well. There are challenges, because something I believe in very strongly is it's the practices or the way we use media that's more important than the technologies. And I think there's far too much concentration on the technologies. At the end of the day, whatever the technology, whether it's television or whether it's a blog, whether it's YouTube, it's what we as people do with those things. Mm-hmm. And they can be used by the forces of light and they can be used by the forces of darkness, as it were.
Yes, absolutely. And we'll explore that in just a few minutes' time. Then social media comes along, or Web 2.0, as people often call it. It's actually not that new, is it? It's been around for a while.
Well, that's a key point, and I've argued quite strongly against the term new media, because one of the most common phrases out there is to call it the new media. But at the end of the day, all of this stuff, whether it's a blog or YouTube, Twitter, it all runs on the internet. Now, the internet has been around since 1969. More specifically, it does run on the World Wide Web, which is, if you like, the part of the web that's got pictures and video and film. And even that's 20 years old. Mm. So at the end of the day, it's running there on a network that's been around for 20 years. Not only that, the software, things like Facebook, they were invented by university students, and they're freeware. So it's not exactly technology coming out of the world's leading technology corporation. This is a 20-year-old network that a bunch of students, in many cases, have got together. But the thing is here, it's how they approach the practices. They decide, instead of making it closed only to a handful of publishers, they decided they would make these online places like blogs and like social networks open to other citizens. And that's what this is all about. At the end of the day, Web 2 is about open communication two-way rather than one-way from a small group.
Yes, it really shows quite a shift in as to whether the technology has enabled the cultural shift, or the cultural shift started to birth the technology. But yes, this whole idea that everybody's voice must be heard, not just simply the privileged few who get to sit behind a microphone or a TV camera or whatever it might be.
Yes, and that really is, in my argument, the what the revolution's about. I've subtitled the book Emergent Communication Practices, and to me, it's not a technology revolution. We're seeing a big shift in the practices of communication because for the last 100 years, it's been more and more governments talking to citizens, sending information, citizens having very few ways to talk back. And what Obama has shown in the US, and to some extent what Australian politicians have started to do in Australia, and government agencies, is they're opening up for people to log on and make comments, whether it's fix a pothole in their street or to have a say about something. And that's the part that people are getting excited about. It's giving a voice back to people.
Mm-hmm. This is Open House Across the Nation. Professor Jim McNamara is Professor of Public Communication at the University of Technology, Sydney, and author of The 21st Century Media Revolution. We're talking about social media, Facebook, Twitter, blog sites, Web 2.0, as it's called, and just the way it's actually changing us as a culture, not just simply a few new technological tools out there. It's actually changing the way we interrelate. Now, let's look at that effect on society and say, let's just focus on, say, three main areas: journalism, business, and politics, which you touched on there. Let's start with journalism, though. I mean, like you were saying before, broadcast media is very kind of top-down, one person and communicates to the rest of the world. Just explore how social media is changing the field of journalism and how that is therefore changing culture as we know it here in Australia.
Well, it's affecting journalism hugely, and it's a great example of where it's a double-edged sword in many cases. I think we have to look at this very maturely and understand that there's huge benefits on offer, but there's also risks and problems, as there is with all problems, and it's very evident in journalism because many people argue that journalism has become far too one way. It's a handful of journalists who are quoting, in fact, a handful of leaders and politicians. The average citizen really can't get into the media unless they sort of stand up in front of a camera at the sporting event or something. And what social media has done is that virtually anyone can publish a blog, and if they're lucky, they can get readers, or they can have a Facebook site, or they can use Twitter and maybe actually break news, maybe get something out there, have a say. And that's very exciting. On the other hand, some people are also concerned that there is a lot of misinformation out there. Once you open the floodgates, of course, you do get misinformation, and there's concern that we're bypassing the gatekeepers of the media who are there to edit and check facts and so on. So at the end of the day, a lot of people are saying there's got to be, you know, a little bit of a happy medium here. There's got to be some checks and balances, but equally, we've got to welcome the opening up of the lines of communication.
Something a little bit tangential to this, but still kind of related, is the whole idea of, say, Wikipedia. And I know we're jumping to the topic of history here, but we've spoken to guests on this show that have said they don't like Wikipedia because it's almost truth by consensus rather than by those who really actually know. If everybody can input into a particular thing, whether it be history in the case of Wikipedia or fact, or indeed news, where is that arbiter that actually does kind of discern what really is, you know, truth and fact from just, say, one particular person's wheelbarrow being pushed?
And that's where it does, you know, without getting heavy about the debate, but that's where it does come down to one's particular philosophy. If you believe that there's a single look at the world and a single way, a single truth, then maybe we need the experts telling us what that truth is. Other people have a philosophy that can result in ideologies being forced on people. And Wikipedia is an interesting example because there has been research done that's compared Wikipedia to Encyclopedia Britannica. And it's been research done by a group of scientists. And lo and behold, they have found that Wikipedia, produced by these ordinary citizens in the main, is almost as accurate, not quite, but very close to being as accurate as Encyclopedia Britannica. Mm-hmm. And then some people go further and say, well, actually, if something is wrong in Encyclopedia Britannica, if there is a mistake, it takes about 3-4 years to correct it. If something's wrong on Wikipedia, people put a flag on it almost within hours, and within a few days, it's fixed. And so this is this idea of, you can either look at people collectively as a mob that can't make sense of things, or you can look at them as having a wisdom when they come together and compare notes. And individuals can be wrong, but many people believe that when you've got a collection of people working together, that truth does get to the surface and it does come through. And that's sort of been proven with Wikipedia.
Fascinating. 1-300-40-2020, if you've got a view on that. Do you rate certain websites of news when we're talking about journalism, as higher than others. Are you happy with the kind of facts you find on Wikipedia and other kind of blog sites when, say, compared to a regular news service? 1-300-40-20-20. Another area is the whole area of business and how that's being changed by Web 2.0 and particular advertising. Just touch on that.
Well, advertising has been in decline for a number of years because with the introduction of TiVo, with television, with the introduction of websites where you can buy software to block advertising because many people are tired of it. Newspapers have found that the classified ads have been moving to eBay and services like that. So advertising has been in decline and really has to go through a change. It has to find new ways to entertain people or to almost win its right to exist, because a lot of people, I think many people are just tired of the interruptive style of advertising that has been out there. And businesses, you know, business models of media that have depended entirely on advertising, they're having to look at other ways of perhaps making revenue. Many people welcome that. The media is certainly not welcoming it because it's putting a real threat on their income. But there's many people out there that would be very happy not to have so much advertising and so many commercials forced into the programs we have. And would prefer to, you know, have their news in a more open way.
And then you touched on politics, and you were talking about Obama there with the use of Twitter and all sorts of other things that they did. How is social media changing politics? And maybe use Obama as a bit of an example.
Yes, many people, and again, it's like journalism. It is revolutionizing politics in one sense. But there's also a sense of it where, at the end of the day, people still want to come together face-to-face. What was very clever in the Obama campaign is a lot of attention was given to how Obama's campaign used the online media, and I interviewed many of the people involved in that, and they certainly used hundreds of thousands of blogs, literally billions of email and text messages. But what they were also cleverly doing that's not so much reported is they were putting out a lot of information to people and saying, here's some information, use this in your own street meeting, your own house meeting. So they were still using the online often to provide information to groups of people who were still having the face-to-face. And the thing we've got to look at with is understand the background here. America's got voluntary voting, and it's been in decline for years and years and years, where a very small number of people are voting, and young people in particular were disengaging from politics. And America just had the largest voter turnout since 1968. So something is working there, and it's far from perfect, but at least people are re-engaging in politics and taking an interest. It doesn't fix all of the problems at all, but I think most people welcome that re-involvement of people. And in Australia, there's examples of people living in the outback who get very little access to politicians or to have a say on policy. And of course, some of them also have problems with communications. But if they do have internet access, people in remote areas, people across boundaries can have a say, can actually talk to government and make a comment. And that's starting to happen not only in election campaigns, but even recently many governments are setting up sites for people to have a say on policy matters.
Now, around the corner is Web 3.0. What is that, and strengths and weaknesses that you can see from this vantage point?
Web 3 is sort of fairly hard to explain in simple terms. First of all, it's not another big shift that people will actually see. It's more a further evolution of the web behind the scenes. But it's quite an important evolution, and it really involves two things. And one of them is sort of quite good, and one has got some concerns about it. Very briefly, to explain the background, most people, anyone who's technical, knows that the web is actually a fairly clumsily constructed network in many ways, because it's actually a whole lot of individual documents written in entirely different programs that are posted on the web. And the only thing that makes it work is basically HTML links, that they're links. Now, those links work by identifying specific words. So we all know if we do a Google search or we use some other search engine, you've got to type in the exact word. And if you don't get the exact word, you don't get it. So it's using natural language. Now, what Web3 is going to do is people are rewriting a lot of the material on the web, and they're using computer language to describe the documents. They call it metadata or meta tags. Now, when they describe the data, when you're searching in future, you will be able to type in, do what we call conceptual searching, where you can describe a problem. You want information about obesity. And even if the word obesity did not appear in items, it would recognize that question because it would check against the metadata stored on the web. So what does all that mean? It means that searching will be even better in future. You won't have to get exact word matches, and it'll start to get to a point where also the intelligent web, or the semantic web, they call it, will also store information, and this is where it gets interesting, it'll store information about the users. So if I am regularly searching for information on health issues, the web will start to recognize I'm interested in health, and it will start to actually recommend the way Amazon Books does at the moment. Now, the problem with that, the downside of that is it means there's an awful lot of capture of personal data going on in the background. And many people are saying there's a very exciting thing here that if we can find information easier, but on the other hand, how much information is there going to be held about you and I and other people, and what will marketers do with that information? Will they use it in responsible ways, or will they start to abuse it? So these are the kind of tensions that are being played out, that there are a lot of benefits, but behind the scenes there are privacy issues in relation to Web 3.
And I'm sure we'll be talking to you again when the next book on Web 3.0 comes out. Thanks for your time, Jim. Appreciate your time.
Well, thank you very much.
Yes, it's Professor Jim McNamara from University of Technology, Sydney, on this whole Web 2.0 thing and soon Web 3.0. Chris has emailed through, used Wikipedia today, love it. Found out something I couldn't find out anywhere else. Thanks for your comment, Chris. So there you go.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit openhouseonline.com.au.